It's a pleasant winter evening here in Prashanti, and I extend a warm welcome to all of you for this week's Radio Sai Answering Booth. Shalom, dear listeners, this is Prem, your friend from Team Radio Sai. This is a show where we deal with questions, confusions and doubts that pop up in our heads time and again. Well, when I started this show, I specifically asked for questions pertaining to practical scenarios in life. But I guess now I'm answering philosophical and theoretical questions more and more. Honestly, I have no complaints about that. But still, I would really appreciate questions pertaining to day-to-day situations and decisions. There's a reason for that. That's because Swami's message and Swami's solutions are so very relevant to our lives, and it would benefit us to view Swami's words through the prism of our own life situations. One thing we must always avoid is the compartmentalization of our life into worldly and spiritual aspects. When we start doing that, probably that's when we tend to think, oh, I'm too young for spirituality. I don't have to think of these things now. It can wait until I'm older. Or we think, right now I have to worry about my career or providing for my family. When I'm a little more settled and I'm more calm, I'll turn to spirituality. But when we realize that spirituality is the essence of life itself, we will take the plunge as early as we can with the feeling that better now than later. For my part, I will try as much as I can to bring out some practical applications even through the philosophical concepts that we speak about. But to be honest, not that I bring out practical aspects, Swami always speaks of philosophical concepts in such a manner that we can learn it and apply it in practical aspects of our life. So today I have a general question. It's a question which is also philosophical from a regular listener, but we'll come to the question when we come to it. Right now it is time for the quote of the week. As always, I have here with me an interesting quote, and these are words of Robert Aiken, a modern day Zen master. And the quote is as follows. We desire permanent existence of ourselves and for our loved ones. And we desire to prove ourselves independent of others and superior to them. These desires conflict with the way things are. Nothing abides, and everything and everyone depends upon everything and everyone else. This conflict causes anguish, and we project this anguish on those we meet. End of quote. Isn't that such a profound thought? We all desire permanent existence for ourselves and for those whom we love, though we know that the only reality of life is that all who are born must die. But we constantly battle the idea of dying or losing someone. In fact, Swami gives a very beautiful twist to this whole paradox. Swami says that you are essentially divine and immortal. You are the Atman which has no destruction. The whole problem is wrong or false identification. Because you identify with the body instead of the Atman, you try to express this nature of Amritatvam or immortality through the body. So instead of merely saying that it is a wrong trait, Swami is pointing to the source of the feeling. We all seek immortality because we are by nature immortal. Only the change in identification is required. But making the same point more general, we can say the same even about our tendency to avoid change. The only eternal attribute of the world is change. In fact, the word Jagat itself means that which is ever changing. And being in such a world, we resist change. And that is the source of all anguish, isn't it? But I'm not suggesting that we must all surrender to the winds of change. Yes, we must stand firm and resist when we have to. And when do we have to? Well, I'll not go into that today, else we will never get to the question. Simply put, we have to resist change either when the change itself is immoral or it is our moral duty to resist the change. But that's not the point today. What I'm trying to suggest is that this recognition that the world is constantly changing and ephemeral will give us more maturity in our outlook. The next point he makes is also so important and relevant. None of us are self-made or independent, yet we behave as though we are so, and we assert our authority. How often we get carried away by such illusions. I have achieved, I am talented, I am educated, I am successful, etc., etc. Even if you have to come first in a race, in a running race, someone has to lose for you to be the winner. for someone to be a topper, others have to come second, third, and so on. For me to be a speaker, I need you all to be listeners, isn't it? But that is still the other end of the spectrum. We could not even be anything or begin to be anything without others. And yet, we think that we are independent. And it is like probably the tip of our fingernails claiming it has an existence of its own. And it has nothing to do with the rest of the body. Just like the nature of this world is changed, the nature of existence itself is interdependence. And when we acknowledge that, we will strive to play our role as best as we can, and we will be humble. When we don't keep these two points the quote talks about in mind, the evanescence of the world and the interdependence of our lives, we are striking against the unchangeable nature of things, and we are bound to face disappointment and anguish. And we tend to inflict these on others. So really, these two points are the cause of much of our restlessness and pain. Before we head to the question of this week, permit me, dear listeners, to read out that beautiful and poignant quote by Robert Aiken one more time. I quote, "We desire permanent existence of ourselves and for our loved ones, and we desire to prove ourselves independent of others and superior to them. These desires conflict with the way things are. Nothing abides, and everything and everyone depends upon everything and everyone else. This conflict causes anguish, and we project this anguish on those we meet." Let's then head to this week's question. As I said, we have a question from a regular listener who wishes to be anonymous. But we've had questions from this person earlier too. The question is in the listener's own voice, so I'll play it out for you. It's an interesting question. Another question on the theory of karma related to that, if I could put it that way. But a different aspect altogether. So let's listen to the question and let's see if we can come up with a suitable answer.
Om Sai Ram. Sai Ram Prem. Congrats for the wonderful coverage of Swami's 92nd birthday programs. And best wishes for a colorful Christmas coverage. Since childhood, a small question has been baffling me and it has remained unanswered. You see, we are told that among all creatures, human beings are the most superior. After millions of births, as small and big creatures, ultimately, they reach the top. Every new birth depends on the karma of previous births, isn't it? I have always wondered what kind of good karma can a bird or an animal do to get promoted to the next, higher stage. Do other creatures also accrue bad karma like us and slip down further? Please explain in your simple, inimitable style. Thank you and Jai Sai Ram.
So that's the question for this week. And it's a question on do animals and birds and bees have karma? It's an interesting one, isn't it? But to start coming out with an answer with that, I think the general thing is, you know, any discussion, we should understand one thing. You know, there is a general theory. There is a general explanation for any concept. And there are always aberrations and exceptions. I mean, even when we are doing science, we are always told that there are always exceptions. There are always, especially when you're studying statistics, there will always be some data which kind of contorts the average. So in this case, what are those things that we probably have to look at as unique cases or cases which are different from the normal? You know, if we go back to our Puranas of the Sanatana Dharma, you'll always find these many stories of, you know, saints cursing some kings or some people to be born as animals, and then they become, you know, a beast, and either a wild animal or they become a lower creature. This is something which we see in the Puranas in so many places. So many animals, you know, many animal births are in this way. A person who is cursed or a person who has fallen from grace might become an animal. And in fact, if you look at all our mythological deities, they all have vahanas or vehicles, which are animals. And if you look at their stories, each of those animals will have a story of how a man or a devotee was blessed with that opportunity or eventually becomes one of those vahanas. In fact, I think just a couple of days back, we had this very beautiful and interesting science bias quote where Swami was talking about these various vahanas. He says that Ganesha has the vahana of a mouse, and you have Lord Vishnu who comes on a Garuda and all of that. And Swami made a very beautiful and important point. He said, see, what is the symbolism which is being portrayed there? The Lord is traveling on an animal or a bird. The idea is, when you look at these animals, you should recognize that these are only dehas, and the dehi or the indweller is always God. The God is being carried by these bodies. Swami said that is the important symbolism. So you always have these, that's in the point which is beside what we're trying to talk. But the idea that there is this special cases of people becoming animals or taking the animal birth based on all of this. In fact, one of the most famous stories in the Bhagavatam, that of Gajendra Moksham, right, where the elephant is being is protected by Lord Vishnu. That story is also has a background of it, of a great devotee being born as a elephant because of a curse. And there are other cases. I mean, these are about the Puranas, and one might wonder if these are mythological. In fact, another story, when you're talking about Puranas, which you have to mention, is another very, very beautiful story in the Bhagavatam. Probably I'll come back to it towards the end of this answer. The life of King Bharata, the king after whom this land has been named, Bharatvarsha or Bharat as we know it today. That king has this very interesting story of, he's a very, very great king, Bharata, and after a certain point in his life, he renounces the kingdom, he hands it over to his successor, and then he comes and lives in the forest in an ashram. And when he's living like that, one day he comes across this very tender deer cub, which is orphaned or something. So he picks it up and he takes care of it, and eventually the story goes that he becomes very, very attached to that deer. And at the point when he's discarding his body, he's actually thinking of the deer. And because that's the most powerful thought in his mind when he is passing away, the story goes that he is born as a deer the next birth. And when this great king, he's a great king, he's a great human being, and a very, very spiritually evolved soul. But because of this last thought, thinking of that deer, he's born a deer. But when he takes the birth of a deer, the story goes that this deer very, very naturally starts going towards the ashrams and the places where the ascetics live. It tends to go and live in those places and you know, give itself to the good company of these great saints. So that's a story where the vasanas of a human life are actually carried on to this animal life, and that is one story. But even otherwise, even if you look at the modern context, Swami would often talk about the two boys who were his classmates during the Kamalapuram days, Ramesh and Paresh. And Swami would often say how those boys were so attached to Swami that, and they were so pure in their love towards Swami, that next birth they were actually born as two little dogs, Jack and Jill, and they came to Swami. And we've heard this story so many times from Swami, and how they eventually merge in Swami. Swami speaks about that. So these are all unique cases of human beings for various reasons. For what reasons? Again, that's a point which is very important. I'll come to that in the end. Might end up in animal births. So these are cases when, if as a human being, because of some reason, you end up in an animal birth, you of course carry forward the karma of your human birth, right? The many human births that you've led, or the few human births that you've led. The karmas that accumulate from that is carried over to the animal birth, and your whatever reason you're born as that animal. But these are, as I said, exclusive cases, unique cases. We'll have to deal with them separately. But in general, if you're talking about that particular statement which Swami would often say, Swami would quote the words of Adi Shankara when he says, Manushatvam, Mukshatvam, Mahapurusha Samshraya. He says, to be born a human being is a very, very, very precious gift, right? To have this human birth is very precious. And Swami would say that you go through 84 lakh species before you get this human birth. And talking about 84 lakh species, I recall when we were studying in school and later in the university, the number of species that we thought that existed from the point of view of science and biology was far, far lesser than 84 lakh. But Swami was always quoting this number, 84 lakh species. And very interestingly, I think maybe a year ago or something, I came across a scientific journal where they come up with this new technique of finding out how many species are there. They've come to this recognition that there might be many, many more species that we have not yet categorized as species or we have not come across. But there's another beautiful biological scientific method by which they can now find out that there are species which are missing and we have not recognized them through a study in biology. And the figure that they are coming to now is very, very close to 84 lakh. So yes, 84 lakh, the point I'm trying to make is Swami says there are 84 lakh species. And this human birth is literally got at the end of 84 lakh species. So that suggests that a soul does go through these many, many births and eventually come to the human birth. So if that is the case, what is the good karma that a soul can do when it is in an animal body or in the body of, say, a bug or a bird or a insect? So that is the question. And I think it's a very important question. And to answer that, as I said, the eccentricities or the special cases, we leave it outside. We'll go to this general discussion. So whenever we talk about dharma, whenever we talk about dharma is equal to good karma, right? We have to go back to the point of right and wrong, the discrimination between good and bad, what is to be done and what should not be done. And when we talk about right and wrong, it goes back to discrimination, the ability to discriminate, and the ability to act on discrimination. I think that's an important point. It's not just about knowing what is right and wrong. The ability to first know what is right and wrong, and then the ability to act upon that discrimination. So in other words, it goes back to the point of free will, the ability to step outside one's impulses or step outside one's nature, which is compelling one to do one thing, and choose to do something which is different. And that is what we refer to as free will. So the ability to decide and act rather than to act on impulse. That becomes the most important thing when we're talking about dharma or good actions and bad actions. Right? So we believe that since humans have the choice to do, right? That's the basis of the idea of doing good actions itself. We have the choice to do. And so we get into this idea of the karma cycle. Either you do good karma and you progress because of your good actions, or you do wrong actions and you keep falling and you get stuck up in this vicious cycle, what we refer to as the karma cycle. So the whole basis of that is this idea that the free will or the ability to make a choice and to act upon the choice, or to discriminate between right and wrong and to act upon that. So when we come to animals, so when we're talking about dharma and karma and when we're talking about animals, we have to essentially see, do they have this free will? Do they have this ability to step out of their nature and make a choice? So do animals always act based on their instinct? We know that animals do act based on instinct most of the time. Do they always act on instinct? Or do they have this free will to make a conscious choice? I think that is what we need to find out to answer this question that has been raised. And this is actually, of course, we are having a philosophical discussion about it, but this is a question which the biologists have been thinking about for a very, very long time. They really want to know, because one of the reasons why they've gone into this study is about animal rights. When we talk about human rights, the reason why we honor human rights is because of the ability of humans to experience pain, and we talk about human dignity, and you know, all of that comes from the fact that a human being can feel pain and the human being can emote, and the human being has his own choices and he should be given the freedom and the space to make those choices, right? All of that idea comes when we talk about human rights. So the reason why we do not give the same importance to animal, a person killing an animal is not going to be persecuted by law the same way a person killing another human being, right? So when these discussions are going on, the biologists wanted to know, how far can you say that an animal is different from a human being? So the debate goes back to this. Do animals have emotions? Do animals have a free will? Is there moral reasoning in animals? So it's not purely based on our philosophical discussion, but even generally, the biologists have always been curious to know whether do animals really have human traits, what we see in human beings. The way, you know, there are many traits which are very similar to human traits. You just have to see one of these TV channels where you have all of these animal life being explained and explored so well. You'll see that there are so many traits which are very similar to animals. I'm sorry, human beings, the way they care for their offsprings, the way they live in a society, the way they come together and live as a community. There are a lot of similarities, the way they hunt and the way they cooperate with each other. There are a lot of similarities, but again, it goes back to the point whether are they doing this as a force of their instinct? Are they acting all of this just based on what is programmed in their head, or are they making a conscious decision to live in that manner or do a certain thing? So that is the point it all comes down to. And many times when they study this, they are not able to prove to a great extent that they are actually choosing to do this, that they are exerting what we refer to as free will, right? So it's very interesting what they started looking for. Since they were not able to ascertain whether this is out of free will, they start looking for an interesting thing, and you know, when they wanted to find an answer to this. And it's a very interesting discussion. We will be able to understand the difference between the animal nature and the human nature, which is pretty much fundamental to moral reasoning and spiritual thinking, right? So what is an animal instinct, right? When we talk about an animal instinct, what is that instinct meant to achieve? I think I've mentioned this a couple of times before. It's all about survival, right? The instinct that is put in an animal's brain is all about survival. That animal needs to live. The animal needs to preserve itself. So when we refer to animal instinct, it's all about survival or self-preservation. So if they can see, if an animal is able to do something which does not literally lead to self-benefit or self-propagation or self-preservation, or even better, if the animal is able to do something that leads to self-harm, maybe that is a sign of free will. I hope you're following me where we are going. So we want to find out whether animals have free will. The way you have to find that is, you have to first define what is animal instinct, and we have to see whether they do something which is removed from this idea of the animal instinct. So what is an animal instinct? Animal instinct is all about self-preservation and self-serving nature. So if an animal is able to do something which is not directly leading to self-preservation, or is doing something which is what we refer to as self-sacrifice, is doing something which is going to harm itself, but it is consciously doing that, then probably that is a sign that there is this idea of free will, or the animal has an ability to exert its free will, right? So for an animal to do that, what is the quality that the animal requires? Now they're stepping it back even further to one more step behind. For an animal to do that, for an animal to do something which is going to harm itself and benefit the other, what is the quality that the animal must have? And when they look at that, it all boils down to the quality of empathy, the ability to sense the other's pain or joy. When will I go out and do something for the other person? When I'm able to sense the other person's joy, or when I'm able to sense the other person's pain. If I know that doing this is going to make that person happy, which means I'm able to empathize with what will make that person happy. Or if I go to serve a person who is in pain, it means I'm able to empathize or feel the pain that that person is undergoing. So it all comes down to empathy when you're talking about the free will to step outside animal instinct and act. It boils down to this quality of empathy. So now they started looking for this quality of empathy in animals, because empathy is the basis of what we refer to as selfless action that we do to benefit others. So the ultimate expression is what we refer to as free will, but it has the basis in sympathy or empathy, not more than sympathy. It has its basis in empathy. Now, that's a very, very beautiful instinct, hint for all of us, even forget the discussion about the animal and free will. But even for us as human beings, I think that's a very, very beautiful hint that this whole study is giving us. So what are we looking for in animals actually finds full expression in human life. We are looking for empathy, and that empathy's final expression is free will. So when you're looking at the pinnacle of human life, you are talking about the ability to express our free will to literally bring out this idea of empathy. And that's why Swami would often say that what is the purpose of this human body? Paropakarartham idam shariram. The very essence or the very perfection of this perfect use of this human body is when we start using this human body for the benefit of others. So you can see the beautiful pattern that we have come to. We are comparing the animal life the animal life form with the human life form. And in the animal life, what are we looking for? We are looking for free will. And when we are looking for free will, it boils down to this idea of, does an animal have the ability to empathize with the other? So even if it has that, the next step is to see whether it can act upon that, right? That's the next point. We'll come to that. But it all boils down to empathy. So when we have to talk about the human being or the perfection of the human state, we have to see, is that person able to act constantly with the other's benefit in mind? Paropakarartham idam shariram. That is the pinnacle of a human life. That's what Swami would often say. So it's a very, very beautiful hint. If we are wanting to lead a perfect human life, are all our choices meant to benefit and serve others? It's not that we have to go out there and burn ourselves. That's not the idea. But you're constantly thinking of how I can make my life useful to others. That is the pinnacle of human life itself. If that is not there, we are still stuck midway between the animal and the human life. And Swami always says this, you know, the feeling of empathy itself is born out of the basic feeling of oneness. So to feel that oneness is clearly the pinnacle of this journey, because that is what the culmination of the spiritual journey is. When you find yourself as part of the whole, or you find yourself as one with all of creation. So that oneness is the ultimate thing. So to feel that oneness, which is the pinnacle of this journey of spirituality, starts with this quality of empathy, right? We'll go back to the discussion about animal and free will. So when they started looking for empathy in animals, what did they find? What did the scientists find? Before I go to that, let me also add an important point about empathy. Empathy is not just about feeling the other's pain, and not just about feeling the other's joy and living selflessly. The idea of empathy is also fundamental to behavioral learning. There are two kinds of learning in animals. You know, there are some learning which is passed on very, very instinctively. If you go back to animal life and see, there are so many such examples. One of the most startling example is that of what they refer to as the salmon rush, where these fish, the salmon fishes, which actually, I don't know, I'm not getting it right, they're either born in the fresh water, or they swim towards the seawater, or they're born in the seawater and swim towards the fresh water. And they actually don't have anybody to guide them. They're not, they take this huge hundreds or thousands of kilometers swim from the sea upstream. Yeah, I think they go back to the fresh water to breed. So this journey happens without being guided or taught by any of their previous generation. It's literally instinctive. So many of the animal learning is instinctive. It's just passed on. The other thing which they often talk about is when a mammal gives birth to an offspring, it automatically starts moving towards the udder of the animal in search of milk. It does not have to be taught that. So it's inbuilt into the animal. But apart from that, there are some behaviors which are learned by looking at the others. That's how we train dogs. That's how we train horses, right? The ability of an animal to look at somebody and learn, even that has its basis in this quality of empathy. And that's one of the reasons why when they study the human, one of the conditions in human life, children with autism, they find that this is the problem. Those parts of the brain which actually express empathy, they are not well developed. And that's how they zero down on the problem, and then they can start working on it. So empathy, apart from giving rise to the feeling that so-and-so is in pain and I feel that pain, or so-and-so is happy about something and I feel that happy, I'm able to emote with that person, that is also born out of empathy. But even this idea of behavioral learning is having the basis on this quality of empathy. So going back to the search for empathy in animals, so what did they really find? Some animals do show the signs of this quality of empathy. And especially if you look at the gamut of animals, the higher animals, or mostly the higher mammals, say the cows, the horses, the elephants, and of course the primates, and the dolphins for that matter. Some of these higher mammals, and of course even some rodents, they find that there is this technique of empathy where they are able to look at the other person and learn, and they are also able to sense the pain of the people around. So that quality is there, and even though it is most of the time, it does get overpowered by the animal instinct, where if put in a condition where probably a primate can feel the pain of the other, the companion, but even then it is always compelled to act upon the instinct. It always compelled to act upon what it will benefit by doing for itself, right? So, but there are signs of this empathy which can be seen in some of these higher mammals, right? So when we talk about this idea of empathy being seen in some of these higher animals, I think it is a suggestion that these mammals probably have a sign of that free will. And as I said, when the moment you talk about free will, then the idea of karma and dharma all start stepping in. But since it still can be overpowered by the animal instinct, probably it's very, very minimal. It is very, traces of the idea of free will is there. So that is why Swami says that in these animals, especially when we talk about cows, of course we know about dogs, the way they can really relate to their human masters. So in these animals, the hint of karma actually starts stepping in, and probably an animal can start stepping forward from these births. But when we are talking about the other species, we are talking about the different 84 lakh species, I think most of them are species which probably don't even have the concept of a brain, or the concept of reasoning, or the concept of doing something. It's all probably very, very automated. When we're talking about all of this, I think what Swami says about the human birth being attained after 84 lakh species holds good, which means when a new soul is trying to go through this journey, I think it essentially goes through each one of these 84 lakh species. Don't ask me how a new soul is born. I don't think there's an answer for that. In fact, Swami says it's pointless to go back to that, why a new soul is born and how a new soul is born and how it goes through this journey. I think it's a different question altogether. And even as a question, Swami says that the human mind does not have the capacity to go back to that understanding. It just happens. And when a new soul goes through this journey, Swami says that it necessarily has to go through these 84 lakh species. And it probably just keeps going from one to the other for the same reason that there is no free will. And when there is no free will, there is no good and bad karma. There is no idea of dharma. So Swami would often say this, even the birds and bees, they all follow their dharma because they don't have a choice. It's all programmed in the head. They do what they're supposed to do, and they lead their life in as perfect a manner as they can, because that's how they're programmed to. So once they live out their life, they start progressing to the next life. So a new soul necessarily passes through all of these 84 lakh species. And since there is no question of free will, there is no question of adharma, and invariably they just spend one lifetime in each one of these stages. When it comes to the advanced animals, as I said, where empathy is seen to step in, and when there can be this idea of selflessness or ability to act upon this idea of empathy or to hold oneself back and act upon the others, I think that is when the ability to probably step up and skip a few births and reach towards the human birth is there. One of the things which comes to my mind is what Swami used to tell about Sai Gita. Whenever Swami would speak about Sai Gita, Swami would say that she's such an evolved soul. It is able to show so much of devotion to Swami. And I guess in one of the occasions, Swami said that for all her devotion, she is going to be given a human birth. And Swami would speak of that as one of the greatest blessings that Sai Gita is going to get for all the devotion that she showed to Swami, which probably means that she's going to skip a few animal births and she's getting that human birth. I'm not too sure of that. Swami has not gone into that detail. But probably this is what it suggests, that the ability to use that free will is there in these higher mammals. And when an animal probably works on that, I don't know how it happens, if it's able to step outside that animal instinct and assert that free will, there is a chance of it skipping a few births and going towards the human birth. But I think what is more important, as I said, this is about the animals. We probably don't have much to do with them or what we can do for them. But it gives us an important insight into what is the idea of humanness. Because many times Swami would often say that the starting step in spirituality is this assertion that we have to do to ourselves, that I'm not an animal, I'm a human being. Swami would say that just by repeating this often, I'm not an animal, I'm a human being, some of the actions that you do will be in the right direction. So this whole discussion gives us such important insights into what is this idea of humanness, right? It starts with compassion, right? It starts with this idea of being able to feel the other person's pain or feel the need of the other person. So it all starts with this emotion of compassion and an assertive action to express that. It's not just about having compassion, because as I said, even these higher mammals start beginning to feel this emotion of empathy, but still they are under the influence of the animal instinct. So even though they feel compassion, most often they might still be doing what their animal instinct, which is self-preservation, suggests them to do. But when we're talking about human beings, this ability to feel compassion and, more importantly, to assertively act upon that and express the idea of compassion, right? But we all know that adharma is not necessarily not showing compassion. When you talk about adharma, when you do not feel the pain of the other person, it does not necessarily become adharma, right? Now we have this self-serving nature in us from the animal nature that is inbuilt into the human brain. One part of the human brain is in fact referred to as the animal brain or the reptilian brain. And it always acts upon this idea of self-preservation. It has to be there. It is part of the human mechanism, right? So we all have this self-serving nature which has come from our animal nature. Now if we start using this free will, we have the self-serving nature and we also have this free will. So if we start using this free will to further this nature of self-serving or self-preservation, that is where adharma begins. I hope you're following me. When you're talking about animals, we are saying that they do not have free will most of the time, and the animal instinct is overpowering even when there are traces of free will. But when you're talking about the human beings, the self-preservation mode is still there because it has come from the animal nature. But this free will and the ability to assert free will has become so much more enhanced when we're talking about the human birth. But what becomes adharma is, what is dharma in the animal and the beasts and the birds? Their dharma is so natural. As Swami says, they do not step outside their nature. They just do what they are programmed to do. But when you talk about human beings, there is this nature which has come from animals, which is actually a form of dharma, the ability to just do what you're supposed to do. But you also have this free will. But now if you use this free will to assert this self-preservation, if you use this free will to enhance your ability to serve yourself, that is where the adharma begins. So by nature, I try to protect the interests of my family, right? Swami says that in animals, there are always internal checks and balances. It will never overdo or overeat or, you know, overindulge. But when we have free will, I can assert this free will, I can assert this self-serving nature of mine, and what would happen when I do that? I become greedy. I start grabbing more than I need. That's what is greed, right? And greed becomes adharma. Same is the case with an emotion like lust. Swami would often say this, in animals, you know, lust is actually a part of the survival mechanism. It's, as I spoke about self-preservation, self-propagation is also one of the qualities which is inbuilt in the animal instinct, right? So it is part of the natural process, self-propagation and continuity. But when man starts exercising this special ability to pursue that lust and push more and more, then it becomes adharma, right? That is when we talk about lust as being one of the internal enemies. That's why Swami would often say this, that even in animals, they have a reason and season, but man does not seem to have any reason and season. So this fundamental idea that you have the animal nature inside and you have this special gift of free will, the ability to step outside of this animal nature and act, that's what makes you human. But Swami says if you use the free will to assert this animal nature more and more, like in the case of greed I spoke of and like in the case of lust, what happens is what Swami very beautifully describes, that you don't live like a human being, but you live like the best animal around, because you are using this special gift which has been given to you to do better what animals do. You're not trying to do something different. What is the different thing that you're supposed to do? The idea of compassion, the idea of selflessness, the idea of paropakarartham. You know, you step out of your self-serving nature and try to help others. Swami says that that is the distinct human quality. The ability to use our free will to express that quality is humanness. Instead, if you use this free will, if you use this intelligence and intellect and to serve yourself better, serve those around you better, and I mean, that's the basis of all corruption and that's the basis of all kinds of things that we see of educated people taking to the wrong ways, right? Using all your intelligence and all your abilities to serve yourself. Swami says when you do that, you do not lead a human life, but you start living like the best animal in the animal kingdom, right? You never live a human life. So there are two things we are actually missing out when we are not living the human life to its potential. One is our dharma. Swami says you are stepping outside your dharma. What you're supposed to do, you're not doing. What you're meant to do, you're not doing, right? You're given a role to play, and when you don't play that, when you don't play that role to perfection, you're actually performing adharma. And then you are not using your free will to assert this sympathy or this empathy or this compassion, which is what differentiates the animal life from the human life. So what we have to do is, one thing, do what we are supposed to do, right? That is what dharma is at the starting point. Play the role that you're supposed to play. Wherever you are placed, something is expected of you, something is the role that is meant to be played by you. Swami says, play it to perfection, that is dharma. And then you must start expressing these qualities of empathy using this free will. In fact, just today I came across this very interesting piece. It was about the scientist called Johann Salk. I hope I'm pronouncing the name right. You know, he's one of the people who came up with the first polio vaccines, right? One of the first few scientists to come up with the polio vaccines. In fact, there are so many other vaccines which came up after that, but the most widely used is the one which was discovered by Johann Salk. And the most important thing about this scientist is he refused to patent this discovery that he made of the vaccine. And, you know, today when they look back and they calculate and they say that this was sometime in the 1950s, if he had chosen to patent this particular discovery of his, he would have made anywhere between 5 and 7 billion US dollars. You know, that's the amount of money that he has given up. And why did he give it up? There's a very interesting interview where they asked him, why didn't you patent your discovery? And he said, are we going to patent the sun? The sun is meant for everybody. You know, what the sun gives is meant for everybody, and that it's not for any one person to lay claim over it. And he said, see, this is a discovery which has come through me. It is for the benefit of mankind. I think, see, this is precisely what we are referring to as a progress from the animal nature to what we refer to as the culmination of human nature. Here is a person who is doing what he is supposed to do. He's probably doing his dharma, but he's exerting his free will. He's using his free will to express this quality of compassion, where you make this conscious choice between what will benefit you, what will serve you, and what is going to serve humanity at large. Probably an animal will never be able to do that, because it is programmed to preserve itself. It's programmed to do what it needs to do to keep itself alive. So this is where, you know, the distinction between being an animal in a human body and marching towards the culmination of a human life comes. Where, what is that which differentiates an animal from a human life? As we said, the basis is the quality of empathy, and in the maximum expression it becomes free will. In the human beings, if you're able to have that empathy, if you're able to look at the other person's pain and feel that, and you can use your free will to assert that quality and become selfless, right? So that is the essence, the essential difference between an animal life and a human life. Now probably we'll have to go back to the idea of the animals and the karma, because that's what the question is all about. So when we're talking about the soul which has to go through these 84 lakh species and reach the human birth, we are talking about a soul which probably progresses in a very methodical manner through all of these species, as I said, till the point where it comes to the higher mammals. And even in that case, primarily I think it just passes on from one birth to the other till it comes to the human life. But one question which probably will come to our mind is, what about the differences we see within animal life itself? We see one dog which is a stray dog which struggles to get its food, but we also see the dog which is probably pampered in a very rich family, and it's a pet which is well taken care of. There seems to be a difference. I think that is where what we started off with as the special cases of people falling down to the level of an animal. Because we were talking here where, you know, what is the distinction between an animal and a human being? So when, I guess, we are constantly living that animal life, or probably leading a superior animal life within a human body, Swami says that is when you actually start falling, and you probably will eventually land up in an animal birth to again rise in this journey. And I guess that is when, with a lot of bad karma, if you end up in an animal birth, I think that's when you see that some animals tend to go through a life which is more miserable than the others. And probably the animals which are going through the rigmarole of going from one birth to the other, one species to the other, will probably lead a neutral life. You know, there's nothing extraordinarily harmful that they go through. But those animals which seem to be either side of the average, either extremely well taken care of or extremely suffering, probably are animals which have karmas which come from a human life, right? Which they have literally fallen. In fact, there's that very beautiful story from the Shirdi Satcharitra where Shirdi Baba is sitting by the banks of a lake or a river, and there is this frog which is constantly croaking, and a devotee comes by, and Shirdi Baba tells him, you know, it's actually a fight between a frog and a snake. So the man goes and looks over, and he sees that there is this snake which is trying to swallow this frog, and he comes back to Baba and says, looks like, you know, that snake is going to eat the frog. So then Shirdi Baba says, no, that will not happen. Why am I here? I will go and stop this whole thing. So Shirdi Baba goes up to that and he starts addressing the snake and the frog. And he says, hey, Veerabhadrappa, hey, Channabasappa, what are you still fighting? hasn't your enmity still ended? You were fighting like this in the previous birth also. Even after being born as a frog and a snake, you still don't seem to have given up your enmity. And he advises them to give it up and, you know, forgive each other. And surprisingly, the snake, which has this frog half into its mouth, it spits out the frog and it goes back into the water, and the frog jumps and goes away. And, I mean, this is a beautiful story which comes in the Shirdi Satcharitra. So when a human being falls to this level of an animal, probably the journey will be different. Probably the journey will not be as described by Swami as a soul has to go through that 84 lakh species, right? So I think this is where, when a human falls from grace and becomes an animal, it comes with the human karmas, come into the animal body, but probably the karmas will be in a suspended state. Because again, as I said, there is no free will in an animal. It literally has to go through that. The soul is the one which goes through the learning process, right? So it literally has to go through whatever it has missed, the lessons that it has failed to learn when it has come to the human birth. It goes through that whole process. And apart from that, as I said, it's not always only bad karma which might lead. I gave you the example of Swami speaking of his classmates being born as Jack and Jill. You know, in that case, probably just for that desire of being close to Swami, those souls did not necessarily have to fall from a human birth to an animal birth, but probably it was a chance for it to be near Swami, or even in the case of the great King Bharata, which we spoke about. You know, the story goes that he becomes a deer and he lives in this ashram, and then he dies. And then he again gets the birth of a very evolved soul. So literally it's a brief period where they go into this animal birth, and all of their good karma is kept in limbo. It's just there. It's not being used, or it's not being lost. And the next birth, the person comes back to a higher birth and continues his progress. So these are things which probably confuse the idea of, is there karma in animals? Can an animal do good karma and progress? But in general, I think since animals don't have these qualities of free will, even when there is empathy, they do not have the absolute power to exert their empathy through their free will. And if we really have to express our humanness or our human birth to its ultimate glory, as Swami says, yes, you have to pull yourself from selflessness. And Swami would so often say this, swartham swaprayojanam. Swami would say that these two, self-interest and selfishness. Swartham is selfishness and swaprayojanam is self-interest. We constantly act on the base of these two. We have a choice. We can assert our choice. We have a free will to choose and do. But Swami says you all the time choose to do those things which are going to serve yourself. You're only using this. I mean, the whole discussion shows how important this idea of free will, or the idea of being able to assert or make a choice and act upon it, is. It's literally central to the spiritual progress, from the animal to the human, from the human to the divine. That's literally the essential, the main difference. And we are using it not to progress, but to assert our animal nature of selfishness and self-interest. It's all right in the animal because it's programmed, but in the human state, if we are still acting on the basis of that, Swami says that, you know, you're leading an animal life in a human body. And as we saw, from empathy, you have the free will, you express the empathy, and that is what expresses as selflessness. And from that selflessness, you actually progress towards the state of oneness. And that's when, from the human state, you have this opportunity to progress to what Swami refers to as the divine state. Or you come to a state where you're able to see the oneness and feel the emotions of every other being as your own. Right? That is the journey. So it's, as I said, it's a philosophical question that was asked. But it has a very, very important lesson for all of us to learn. It really, I think, we can look back into our life and constantly see how many of our choices are like that. How many of our choices we are making, as Swami would say, are you living like an animal human, or a human human, or a divine human? That's a question that you need to ask. So this is what it is. So, I mean, every time we talk about karma, every time we talk about dharma, the question will always go back to, are we all animals which are driven by our own instincts, are driven by our own vasanas, or do we have the choice to pull ourselves up and change our course? So that is what is essentially the human nature. Yes, we all have the ability, and the question is, what are we using that ability for? So I thank the listener for asking this question. It's a very beautiful question. I think it's a question which must have been in the minds of many. It's been in my mind for a long time too. So I had the opportunity to address that. Thank you for asking that question. If there's anything more that you would like to ask on the same theme, I'll be happy to address that too. You can write into me. So with that, dear listeners, it's time for me to wrap up this week's show. We had an interesting question. If you have a question, especially if you have a question on the practical problems that we face in everyday life and you're wondering what is the solution that Swami would give or what is the way Swami would like us to deal with that problem, feel free to write to me. You can write in to prem@radiosai.org. That's prem@radiosai.org. That's my personal mail ID. The mails that you send there are going to be read only by me. So if you wish to be anonymous, please let me know. I will not mention your name. But if you can record your question in your own voice, like I had the opportunity to play today, it would be wonderful. It's always nice to listen to fresh voices on the show. I most humbly offer this effort at Swami's Lotus Feet. Today, the 14th of December, it's a very special day. It was the day on which Swami entered what we refer to as the Patha Mandiram, or the old Mandir, before Swami moved to the Prashanthi Nilayam in the year 1945. The 14th of December, Swami did the Griha Pravesham of the old Mandir. So it's a very special day. So I'm going to leave you with a song which has the flavor of nostalgia. It's from one of those melodies that used to be sung during the old Mandir days. On the other side of it, you'll be joined by Brother Bishu with his guests for the last segment of the day, the Vahini Satsang. I'll meet you all next week at 7:30 for the next episode of Radio Sai Answering Booth. Cheese!